Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. Recovery Cast is a podcast by and for people in recovery, with a particular emphasis on the Narcotics Anonymous experience. You can find us on the web at myrecoverycast.com, and there you can find all the info and links you'll need to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, Stitcher, and any number of other sites that serve up podcast content. If you don't find us with your favorite podcast app, let us know, and we'll make sure you can. The topic for today's episode is The Impossible Dream, a history book written recently by the Fellowship in New York City. Dave and I were interested in this topic along two lines. One, the history of NA in that city is quite rich. As we discussed in our second episode of this season, that history unfolded in two separate periods. The first period started in 1949 when an addict named Danny Carlson was released from the federal narcotics farm in Lexington, Kentucky, and came home to New York City to start the first meeting ever to bear the name Narcotics Anonymous. That version of NA continued in New York and spread to some other cities, but did not adopt the traditions and faded out in the early 70s. The second period of NA in New York began in 1981, when some addicts in New York began to hold meetings of the NA Fellowship, first started by Jimmy Kay and others in Los Angeles. So an overview of that history is one focus of this podcast. The other is the experience of writing a history book for a particular region of the Fellowship. We sat down with three members from New York who were involved throughout this project to ask them about both of those stories. Peter and Lynn are longtime members of NA in New York, and Catherine is a New York member who was asked to bring her experience as a writer to the project. On the day of the interview, Catherine was quite ill and had lost her voice, but she showed up anyway and participated via text while the interview was underway. Lynn and I read some of those during the interview, and I added some later. To start out, let's listen in on portions of the interview when we were talking about the hopes for the project and the feelings about the book itself when it was finally published. The event we discussed in the opening segment was a launch party held in New York City once the book had been completed.
I was sort of paying attention from afar what you guys were up to, and you kind of expect to see in the end, like a three-ring binder with some nice notes and maybe bound in some way. And then Dave went to that event and he sent me the book, and I sat down and began to read it, and I thought, oh man, this is just fantastic. The writing, the research, the thoroughness, the fairness, I felt like you guys just did an outstanding job on this project.
Let's not forget that kickoff event in Manhattan last February.
Yeah, thank
it was just
you
one
that.
Of the greatest NA events I attended. Speakers all day long, fabulous food, and people who really that are written about here, pioneers coming back to share their experience, strength, and hope. So it was a great event.
This book gave the history of New York, but it also created what we call a living archive. I believe we're up to approximately 15 members who were interviewed for this book that have passed. And there were quite a few that passed before, some of the founding members in New York, that passed before we got going on the book, including Tony Daddio. So now in our records, we have a living archive of those members that have passed and those that have yet to go for perpetuity. One of the things that we talked about in committee was how we want the book to feel when somebody reads it, is that we wanted this book to read like a novel because of the nature of who we are in New York and the nature of the characters and the different scenarios, locales, the ethnicity of New York, that we really felt the book should read more like a novel and less like a textbook, and I really believe we succeeded in that.
Then I asked Dave to take the lead and begin the questioning.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Hi, everybody. I first heard about this project about maybe 6 months before the World Convention of NA in Philadelphia, and I was really delighted to hear about it. And I guess, Lynn, Catherine, Peter, whoever, tell us what the origin of this was. What got it going, and what were the early days of that project like?
I was at the World Service Conference as an RD in 2006. I discovered at the conference that there were three history books for sale. The Florida book, the Australia book, and the New Zealand book. Two of the three were magazine-style format. The Florida book was a hardcover. I picked up copies of the books, and I came back with the sense that we should do the history in New York. So upon returning and delivering my conference report, I started to pull people from the region and people that I knew on the side. One of the first people I contacted was Lynn to see what she thought. I talked to others as well, and it was unanimous support that we should do this, but that we needed to present it to the region so that it would be a regional project and funded by the region. The committee was made a part of Literature Review as an ad hoc committee of Literature Review. We didn't request a budget at that time, but we were now a committee. The first meeting of the committee took place in February 2007 at Marlikna in my room. I was staying at the Host Hotel, and a bunch of people, Ben, James, Pam from Pennsylvania, Hank, and a few other people got together, and we had our first meeting and talked about what we wanted to do and, you know, where we were going and a timeline.
So tell us, this committee that got put together, how did you come up with your protocols, and how did you get to work?
The initial concept was to talk about the first meeting, which was in April 1981, until a defined cutoff date of the end of May 1985, because it was a general consensus that to cover all the history would be more like an encyclopedia and less than a history book, and it would be too much and too long of a task. But because we had lost some members like Tony Daddio and Betsy, and a few of the other founding members, we felt that our intention and our focus should be to capture the history in that time period.
Okay, so how many people were on the committee, Peter?
I would say approximately seven at that time.
Okay. Now, obviously, New York has a very interesting history. In essence, it could be looked at as two histories, but we know that there was a Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous in 1949, started by Danny C. What was the discussion within the committee as to how to handle that fellowship?
It was a very heated discussion. Half the room felt that to entertain anything pre-1981 would be to, but this is not what were signed on for. We were going to do 1981 to 1985. And then the other half of the room felt that there was no way that we could ethically start talking about 1981 if we didn't talk about what came before that. And then the other part of the discussion was, this is great. We're going to really piss off California. and there were some of us who didn't want to do that either. So we didn't make a decision at that meeting. We decided to sit with it until the following month. And basically, you know, what we decided was to not add the pre-1981 stuff would be doing a disservice to those people and the work that they did. And we brought that back to the committee the following month with a new skeleton of the chapters and how it would break down. And it was accepted.
Prior, we had been in contact with Big J in Florida, mm-hmm. and Big J sent us a copy of a certificate of incorporation from February 1951, showing the corporation of the name Narcotics Anonymous in New York. And that was where the discussion, to go back to the beginnings, really started, because we were being prompted to not overlook the prehistory. And once that paper arrived, that began to turn people around, showing that indeed there was something substantial. But the final decision was not made until we got a copy of an original piece of literature called Our Way of Life.
Our Way of Life was a booklet published by the Addicts Anonymous Group in the Lexington Hospital. And in 1951, it was published as a leaflet by Danny Carlson's Narcotics Anonymous Group in New York. In an early interview, Danny mentions that this was borrowed from Alcoholics Anonymous, but so far, no one has been able to find any record of that. Boyd and Chris, our intrepid historians, are looking into this. For now, all we really know is that when you hear Our Way of Life, think Danny Carlson's N.A., not Jimmy Kinnan's.
There's a lot of research we did, including letters between Bill Wilson and Betty T. from Jimmy K.'s home group, and others talking about contacting Danny Carlson, and others that showed there was an effort pre-April 1953 to contact Narcotics Anonymous in New York from California, but we were telling our history, the history of Narcotics Anonymous in New York, and our history includes what went down from 48 through 68 when it finally died in New York. And there were, as we found later, there were many offshoots in New Jersey, Cleveland, Atlanta that continued to survive until they had contact for literature from California.
Did I just hear that when the Danny Carlson effort kind of petered out, or whatever the right word is, in the 60s, there was no Narcotics Anonymous in New York from that time until 1981?
Right, and actually the one thing I wanted to say was that the McBurney meeting at the Y, which was a meeting that began with Danny Carlson and Father Egan used to go to that meeting, was until 1972, not 1968.
Okay.
So from 1972 until 1981, there was no official Narcotics Anonymous. So Lynn A. was from upstate New York, and she went out to California to get clean. She'd heard about it, and she got clean, and she came back and tried to start NA upstate, having nothing, no contact with us down here, except I think at one point Jimmy was trying to encourage her to go out to Long Island and start a meeting that somebody out there called him. But that's already like the late 70s, yeah. And there was a little rumble, right, Peter, about a meeting at the Freeport Hospital?
Yes, but we couldn't get three independent sources to verify. We only had two. There were quite a few clean and dry meetings, as AA would call them, including both sides of the coin and a meeting up in Harlem. And there were a lot of addicts who were not comfortable in those meetings, but went anyway because that was the only game in town.
Before we leave this topic of the original fellowship in New York, you said, Lynn, there were meetings at McBurney until 1972?
Yeah, there was at least one NA meeting there until 1972.
Okay, but they were not, there was certainly NA literature was available, namely the Little White Book.
I mean, they were using Our Way of Life.
I understand.
Which was also generated locally.
The point I was making, you're actually making my point, is that there was, on the West Coast, there's a fellowship flourishing. They're publishing the Little White Book, the Little Buff Book that, you know, gets dispersed around the country. The New York meeting had nothing to do with that, as I understand it, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we could really look at it as two separate fellowships. There was no effort prior to 1972 to fall into step with what was going on the West Coast. Is that correct?
Right. And that's why I was saying that sometime in the late 70s, when Enter started to have, I don't know if they were calling it NA yet, but somebody who was volunteering editor had gone out to California for something, found out there was NA there.
What's Enter?
There was sort of like a non-denominational church affiliation trying to help addicts up in Harlem.
Okay.
And somebody went somewhere and they found out there was this thing called NA, and they went out to California to try and find literature, and I think they came back with like one pamphlet.
Okay, but it's real clear that then the committee made an absolute commitment to include that fellowship in the history.
Absolutely.
So you really break it down, as you do, in time periods. There's this early fellowship. Then it disappears, and you have this period of time where addicts are really struggling to get the message of recovery, and they're trying to fit into Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell us about that part of it. You know, what did you find in terms of AA's willingness to, in some fashion, provide a form for addicts?
In those days, it was more on interpersonal relationships between people at the meetings that established a safe haven for addicts to go. But the general attitude in AA is you can't talk about that here. You need to take it on the road and go somewhere else. I was shown the door personally a few times, and that was the pervasive attitude in the early 80s for addicts.
Of the 140 plus people that we interviewed for this book, I would have to say that half of them did not have that experience. Half of them were welcomed, but they did not feel that it was the right place for them. But half the people that we interviewed are still grateful to AA to this day. There was a very wide variety of experiences here in New York with how people were treated in AA.
Okay, well tell us what the real challenges were putting this together. How do you get this vast foundation of information into a book?
So one of the challenges was just the geography of New York at that time, because there were no service entities. So it's not like it was easy for us to figure out who to include and who to exclude in the history. And ultimately what happened is that we really felt like we had to include all of New York State. So that was one of the challenges, was how to find people outside of our realm of experience to talk to. So there were a lot of road trips that we took to meet with people.
How do you handle the member who you know had some role in the early days, the pioneer days of Narcotics Anonymous in New York, yet they no longer attend NA meetings? Perhaps they're in another fellowship, or they don't go to meetings at all. Do you go ahead and interview them anyway?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the basic decision that we made was that if they played a part during that period in time and we could find them, then we were going to talk to them.
We tried to be as thorough as possible. We had flyers out for 5 years asking for people who were there in the beginning or had any kind of memorabilia or anything. For 5 years, we circulated flyers at the area, at the region, and at the groups asking for people to come in.
How was the support throughout the fellowship? Did they respond?
Let's just say that I don't think anybody showed up to those meetings for the entire 8 years, Peter?
We had a couple of new members show up, but, you know, the support was lacking all the way around. I want to just take a moment and talk about one of the turning points in the history book committee itself. And that was, you know, Lynn came on and helped us get a little bit more formal in the way we were dealing with things. And then Lynn introduced the committee to Catherine.
That's not true. Catherine was there when you guys interviewed me.
Is that right?
That exchange right there brings up an interesting point, that when you have differing accounts, both of whom were there or say they were there, how did you deal with trying to establish the credibility of one account versus another?
What we did was, as a committee, we decided to use what's known as journalistic integrity. And that means that no verbal fact is a fact unless verified by the fact giver and two additional, three independent sources making a verbal fact a reality. Meeting lists, literature printing, stuff like that. That's black and white. That's a fact.
I took a moment here to include some of what Catherine had been texting.
One of the things that she recently just texted was that on the question of how did we handle members that were hard to find, she says this was a huge problem. That in fact, two important people were contacted just weeks before they went to press. And as far as members going who were going to AA, in some cases, they just had no way to contact them, couldn't find them. All told, they interviewed 160 people, many of them twice. So just a bit of Catherine's addition to the conversation.
Yes, and there's quite a few people that we interviewed that are not addicts. They're not in the program, any of the programs. They're outsiders, but were instrumental in helping us get it going or having done other things to help it get going in New York.
Okay, so in terms of how you're compiling, you're doing interviews, you're compiling the results of interviews, you're doing research, presumably, and you're gathering documentary record. You must have had a very large and sometimes contradictory body of information that you were drawing from. Is that a fair statement?
What we did was we interviewed everybody with digital tape recorders, and then either I or Catherine, we tried a couple times to get some other people to do it, but nobody really wanted to do it. We would upload those interviews to our computers and transcribe them. So once we would transcribe the interview, we would email it to everybody on the committee and then bring hard copies to the next meeting, and we would go through the transcript together. Just so that everybody got a chance to hear the interviews that we had done during that previous period. And so we were compiling all of these interviews, all these transcripts. And in the interim, Catherine was going through them at home, trying to figure out what bits of each interview would fall into what chapters as they stood at that point in time. And what information they were giving that would flesh out those events that we had used to create, you know, to push out the chapters, and also what information was given that served as springboards for more research that we had to do, more people that we had to find, more questions we had to ask, etc. That took up a tremendous amount of time. I would say maybe what, a year or two at least.
And then on the topic of who writes the book, did you pick a single writer?
Yes. And it's the voiceless one.
The voiceless one here, Catherine.
Yes.
In fact, Catherine put something up on our little chat thing. Let me read it. She says, I was a GSR to the Manhattan area when I heard about the book project. At the time, I had a year and 3 months. I knew nothing. I called Jimmy Kimmel. The subcommittee had no reason to have any faith in me. So that's the humble statement of Catherine. But I take it Catherine had some talents, some background. You guys live in the publishing capital of the world. Catherine is probably somebody who had some background doing this sort of thing. Is that true?
Catherine is an author, and she has done this for decades.
Okay.
I found out later that Catherine was an experienced ghostwriter, so this book was right up her alley. The Impossible Dream was her 24th book.
You know, Lynn talked about how we did the interviews, but we didn't talk about how we gathered the information from the hard material. Originally, we had a lot of minutes from the areas, the region, whatever it was called. It had a number of different names back in the day. And we went back and we put together a timeline and bullet points to significant events. And that helped us focus in on the things that we needed to gather further information on.
Here's a little bit from the book's preface on this. We were amazed to find that these scattered bits of information slid together like pieces of a giant puzzle, revealing a synchronicity that we didn't expect to find. It is a story of how many addicts seeking recovery in different parts of the region, often without knowledge of each other, started Narcotics Anonymous meetings in their own neighborhoods, each playing a role in a drama that was much greater than any of them knew. By necessity, much of this history is based on collective memory, as writing things down for future reference was not high on anyone's agenda back then. There are gaps in our archives of area and regional minutes, early meeting lists are rare and often undated, and World Service records of registered meetings in New York City for that time are not available.
Something else that Catherine wrote here was that the most important task was collecting early meeting lists. They tell much. Fortunately, many members still had them. Unfortunately, many of those meeting lists weren't dated by year. You know, trying to figure it out. The really good thing was that once WCNA 13 happened, that icon, that logo became part of the meeting list, so we could pretty much say what was pre or post 1983.
We had members who were there who were able to help us to place chronological order to which meeting list came first, second, third, fourth, etc. And we were able to put them in a chronological order.
At this point, I mentioned the Rockefeller Laws, a phrase commonly used to describe a set of laws and law enforcement practices that, it is frequently said, prevented addicts from associating with one another in New York, thereby making NA impractical. This led to an interesting clarification from those who had so recently done this research.
From our discovery, there were no Rockefeller Laws. It was the law of collusion, and it was the Rockefeller sentencing statutes under the law of collusion that was so severe for addicts. And it was those sentencing statutes that created it. But all of us, including myself, always refer to it as the Rockefeller Law. But there indeed, the law of collusion was dating back until the 50s.
That's interesting. So it's a common way that people refer to them, but in fact, there was no such thing called the Rockefeller Laws.
Right. The law of collusion was the one that prevented us from gathering, and that was what Danny was up against. Like when he came back from Lexington that last time, and decided that he couldn't have a fellowship called Addicts Anonymous because it would get confused with AA, and he created the term Narcotics Anonymous, which was, I think, primarily because all drugs were referred to by the police as narcotics, and it just made sense. The issue was, how do you get addicts, how do you make it possible for them to come together and meet for something like a recovery meeting if it's against the law for them to meet?
It strikes me that phenomenon is common in many places. I remember when I was at the World Service Office, that was being said of Mexico, that they were trying to get NA going in Mexico, but it was essentially illegal because there were laws against collusion, as you're saying here. And we interviewed somebody from Iran recently who told us the same story. So there must have been a PR success of some kind which turned that corner, that either the law, whatever laws there were repealed, or somebody began to hear us out, because something happened between 1970s and 1981 when NA took off, where that no longer became a problem. Did you ever identify what that was that happened?
That's a really good question. I don't know if anything actually happened that made it possible, but I do think that what we had in New York that we didn't have in the 40s was we had more of a knowledge of other people around the country. There was some established NA around, and that I think that may have served as a support. There was certainly a softening of how to cope with addiction. There were rehabs all over the country already at that point. And also the other thing is that churches started opening their doors to us. There was no way that the cops could go into a church and arrest people for meeting there.
Lynn is about to mention the names of a couple priests who were particularly helpful. One is Father Ahern, later Monsignor Ahern, who ran a place called the Third Street Men's Shelter in the Bowery District of New York City. Here are a couple of readings from page 118 of the book in a section entitled Bleecker Street. If we don't serve the counterculture, then what are we here for? Monsignor John Ahern. The Bowery in the early 80s was a far cry from what it is today. Then it was the Lower East Side's down and dirty Skid Row, the national symbol for urban blight. Crime-plagued, burned-out ruins, abandoned tenements, flop houses, men lying on the sidewalks in an alcoholic stupor. It was the original boulevard of broken dreams. Around the corner, quote, down a trapdoor that led to the sub-basement of hell, unquote, was the Third Street Men's Shelter, run by the city. And it had a reputation for notoriety even in that neighborhood. It was also the home of the first downtown Narcotics Anonymous meeting in Manhattan. With his usual understatement, Monsignor John Ahern said of his mission there, "Social workers were warned to take the elevator, not the stairs. I took the stairs." At that time, he was Father Ahern. He had been working with alcoholics since the 1950s and had nothing but praise for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Father Ahern first learned about Narcotics Anonymous in 1981 when he got a call from Father Terry Attridge, a priest in the New York Archdiocese who was appointed to do research on addiction. Quote, he ran into a fellow called Terry R., who was looking for a meeting space after apparently giving a great presentation. Father Attridge asked me, "You got space for a meeting down there?" And that was it. I had seen AA work, and if there was something that was going to work for people who use drugs, we had to try it. And then a little bit later on the night of the first meeting, Father Ahern remembers that Terry R. arrived early and was sitting on the step outside Holy Name when a woman was mugged coming out of the AA meeting. Quote, as I walked outside, there's Terry running past me with a machete in his hand, chasing the mugger. He didn't catch him, and when he came back, he said, "I'm a little out of shape." I said, "Put that away," and he said, "Don't worry about it. I'm clean, but I'm still a little crazy." According to Terry, it wasn't a machete. Quote, it was a 12-inch knife that folded into the handle. I didn't run around with a machete, unquote. Priests don't know their knives. The other priest Lynn will mention is Father Dan Egan. If you listen to our interview with Tom C. from Hawaii, you may remember his name as someone Tom met in India at Mother Teresa's place. Father Egan was there to help strategize ways to help the addicted population on the streets of Calcutta. But back in the 1960s, he was working intensively with the movement started by Danny Carlson in New York, and again when our fellowship took hold there in 1981. Father Egan wrote a book called The Junkie Priest, and addressed both the 1983 World Convention in New York City and the 1984 World Convention in Chicago.
So that may have played a part as well between Egan and Ahern and other priests. I mean, we had so many priests in New York City that made it possible for us to have meetings. I don't think it would have happened without that support and that participation from them.
That's interesting. It's starting to shape up like more of a PR success, not just of the New York Fellowship, but of the Fellowship as a whole. In other words, NA gets more well-known. And I'd never thought of it in those terms, but you just put it in interesting terms, Lynn. And Catherine was weighing in a little bit there, too. She said those laws that we're calling the Rockefeller laws by whatever name are still in effect, except for sentencing. She says the cops just stopped enforcing the laws, which is an interesting point. Also a point that the Iranians made when we talked to them. They said the laws are still there, but it became obvious to the cops and to the authorities that they're going to have more success not enforcing them and supporting recovery efforts than being up against them. And then Catherine also says, the laws Peter refers to go back to the 40s. The reason why New York City NA was so difficult, the reason NA in New York was hard to get started, was their early meetings were raided. And this also is something that the New York Fellowship shares with the Los Angeles Fellowship. They talk about rabbit meetings, meaning meetings that they would move around to members' homes, because when the cops would figure out where they were meeting, they would surveil them, which also is interesting origin of that are under no surveillance at any time, which is a phrase in our literature that some people have a hard time with. But it was a reassurance of the early members that that's not what's going on at NA anymore. So finishing what Catherine was saying, everybody at the meeting with a prior got sent back to jail. Imagine the difficulty encouraging suffering addicts to come to a meeting. What caused the change, according to many addicts we interviewed, was that there were just too many addicts by the 70s, and, quote, that included cops, unquote. So I guess that made the difference.
Yeah, I think it was a societal acceptance of the disease concept that changed attitudes in general, and a significant indicator of that is when insurance companies started paying for addicts and alcoholics to receive treatment.
That's a very interesting point, too, that the 80s were characterized by the rise of treatment centers and people en masse being referred to 12-step meetings, primarily AA, but as NA got established and got its name out there more, AA and NA. So that coincides also with the rise of NA in New York.
You also had something going on over here, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was going on elsewhere. You know, in the early 80s, there was one gentleman that we interviewed who was, he had that kind of a position at Con Ed where he could help people who worked at Con Ed go away for treatment for alcoholism. And more the people who were coming to him were addicts, not alcoholics. And so he actually started the first NA meeting up in the Bronx.
All right, well, let's shift again back to what it was like to write this book. And so I think where we had kind of gotten with that narrative was you created the committee, you began to solicit input. It was a slow go. You did it over a period, it sounds like, of about 5 years of putting flyers out there, doing interviews, interviewing a total of about 160 people, gathering documentary evidence, comparing versions, trying to sort it all out. And then now you have a body of material to turn into a book. So how did you do it? Did you start coming up with drafts, circulating drafts? Tell us some stories. How did this go?
So Catherine would work on a chapter, and I would come over, and we would go over it together and determine whether or not it was comprehensive, thorough, if there was anything that I think we should add. And there were three or four chapters where neither of us were here for it, because it was all stuff that happened before 1981. And then there was a bunch of chapters that was during a period when Catherine wasn't here, but I was. So it was easier for me to do fact-checking because I knew the people and I had a better memory of that stuff. And then the later chapters, there were a couple of chapters that were really, really almost painful because some of those people were alive still. And how do we talk about stuff that was ugly or controversial or painful in that moment and not make anybody look bad? You know, like just trying to remember that nobody here has even maybe 5 years of recovery when these things are happening. So some of the experience of writing it was emotional because of that. But the basic process was that Catherine would write a draft of a chapter, and I would come over and we would read it together and we would make a few changes, whatever, and then we would bring it to committee and then we would read it all together. Actually, we read it out loud, each chapter, and then the committee might have some input. Something may have been forgotten, or they would have, you know, should it be past or present tense or whatever, and then we would go back with those changes and make those changes, and then we would sort of say, okay, for now, that chapter is done, until, you know, something big may change. And towards the end, a number of big things did come about that we made some tweaks on.
How long between, I think you said you were gathering input for about 5 years, and then how long working with the material did it take to get to a final published book?
That's a good question. What we decided at a certain point was it's enough. We have enough of those almost template interviews where we asked everybody the same like 25 or 30 questions where we stopped doing that. And the only interviews that we would do after that was to fill in the gaps. Or if we found somebody that we never expected to find and that we wanted to interview them and include that somehow. I would say that the last 2 years, Catherine, or 3 years, was just purely writing.
Let me read what Catherine wrote here. Some of this she wrote a little bit ago and some of it she just finished writing. At a certain point, this became God's book. We had to put away our frustrations and resentments because it was clear that this book would save lives. Then she was responding to my question, how long did it take? I started writing early on things people said that really moved me. These I filed away until the actual writing began. So I think it's accurate to say that the writing took about 7 years.
I don't know. I don't know if any of us really thought that anybody would have major feelings about what we were uncovering and what we were talking about in the history book. But there were absolutely a core group of people, not just in New York either, that were very upset with us for talking about the pre-1981 stuff. And I think that it didn't matter to us to a certain extent. We had a conscience and we were going to move forward with the book because we knew that what we were talking about was truthful and historically accurate. And we felt spiritually important and powerful. But I do think that anybody in NA who's about to undergo or embark on this journey of recording their history needs to understand that we all personally don't like change and that we're so invested in a certain story that we have that if anybody comes and changes it, even if it's true, it's going to ruffle feathers. So you sort of have to be prepared for that and be willing to stand your ground, you know, because you're telling the truth and that's what we're supposed to be doing here anyway.
All right, so there's two stories we're telling. One is the story of writing a book and the impact on a community. The other story is the story of NA in New York. So a little bit of that, the significance of the convention as you guys uncovered it in the course of writing this book. And some of you were there, of course.
Just one little story about the World Convention. The Thursday before the convention started, I went down. I heard that the basic text was for sale. So I went in to buy basic text, and I go to the literature table, which is right next to the registration table, and this guy says he's got two basic texts left. Do I want them? They were $25 a piece. So I bought the two basic texts, and I gave the guy a hug, and one of the women who was there with him said, "Oh, you know, he's not an addict, right?" I said, "I don't care. He sold me these. It was the last two. They had one more beyond that, which was going to be auctioned off at the Sunday spiritual breakfast. But I bought the last two that they had for sale. And it turned out it was Bob Stone that sold me the books. So for me to say that it had a very significant impact on me, it certainly did. And it just went up from there. As far as impact on the New York Fellowship, we went from a handful of meetings in each borough and out of the borough to like a couple of hundred meetings after the World Convention. The growth was exponential. NA meetings would pop up weekly, new meetings weekly, and soon you didn't have to leave a borough to make a meeting. Every day of the week. The impact that it had on New York is lasting until this very day because the foundation that we have really came out of the result of WCNA 13.
Hmm. Well, you made an interesting point there. You said you heard that the book was going to be available at this convention, and it just occurred to me that the timeline there was that the book was published in 82 or was approved in 82, but that there was a lot of difficulty getting it to the streets, so to speak. So it must have been just sort of becoming, just sort of getting published and available, about coincidental with your convention. Is that true?
And Catherine texted at this point, "The combination of the first edition and the convention at the same time was like dynamite. All of a sudden, everyone was quite literally on the same page."
Up until that time, all we had in New York was unapproved mimeograph copies of pages out of the text. That was it. That's all we saw. We didn't see anything else. We had the little white book, and we had a few IPs, but that was it.
We have to remember that WCNA 13 was one of the last world conventions that wasn't put on by World. Like, how many years after that was it that World started putting on the conventions themselves?
At the time of this convention, which was the 13th annual World Convention of NA, there was a bidding process held at each World Convention to determine where the next one was going to be. There was no central management of this convention from year to year. Each host city formed a committee, and that local committee had full responsibility for the convention. The following one in 1984 was in Chicago. In 1985, it was in Washington, D.C. By then, as the convention continued to grow, so did the concern that such a large event, with all of the liability that goes along with it, should probably be managed by NA World Services and not come under brand new, potentially inexperienced management each year. The bid at the event in D.C. was awarded to London, England, the first time the convention would be held outside the U.S. At that point, the World Convention Corporation, a subsidiary of NA World Services, was formally established by the World Service Conference, and the convention has been under the management of NA World Services ever since. The World Convention Corporation, however, was folded into the single corporation Narcotics Anonymous World Services, or NAS, in 1998 as part of a complete restructuring of NA World Services.
And the reason why this is significant for us is that that entire year, when they came back from Milwaukee, so from September 82 until September 83, we were not only trying to, I think we had just gotten seated as a region in May of 83. You know, John F. Seconded the motion, or made the motion, to seat New York as a region. We were a freaking area. I think we had like 9 meetings. And so that entire year, I think that the fundraising activities that we engaged in and the cooperation that we got from the rest of the East Coast, especially Pennsylvania, because Philly was constantly coming and supporting us, that also helped and to bolster us and support our growth. You know, so the fact that we were solely responsible for making this thing happen, you know, it was sort of like the weight of the world on the one hand, and also this, it was exciting to have that much responsibility, that like we were personally actively participating and making it possible for addicts to find recovery in New York. And it wasn't somebody else coming in and doing it for us. So which didn't actually help our ego, but that was, you know, I think that that played a part in it.
And I can say I was there. I attended that convention, and it was absolutely palpable in the air, the energy, that kind of energy, the energy of NA coming into its own in New York. And we should say it was in the Vista International Hotel, which it was the hotel adjoining the Twin Towers too, right?
Yes. So another thing that the convention gave us, even though we were responsible for it, it was one of the last when the region put it on, we were getting visits from trustees at that time. I remember meeting Carl B. a few times, coming to lend guidance and support to the region in putting on this event. And he was there specifically for that. I remember the impression I had of him, the first NA member that I ever met with double digit clean time back then. And it was very impressive to me, because I had never seen anybody in NA. The other fellowship, yes, but NA, no. And he came special to New York. And the advantage we got out of not just his participation, but the convention taking place, is the organizational skills we learned and how to form a committee, how to work together for a joint purpose, and the general layout of what the organization should be like was substantially advanced by this event taking place in New York.
Yes, interesting stuff, which is sort of the backstory of NA service in general, right? We learn so many things that we learn by doing service. Okay, I know New York was just absolutely hammered by the AIDS epidemic in the 80s. Anything to be said about that?
If I could just maybe ask a question as a lead into that. I was present at, what was the clubhouse on St. Mark's Place?
The Howe Club.
Yeah, and it would have been somewhere in, I guess, the mid-90s, and I caught their anniversary meeting, and their format was they had about 10 or 12 speakers, and it was one of the most powerful meetings I ever attended, because my recollection is that almost all of them were infected with HIV, and there was that kind of cloud hanging over the meeting. So what was it like in New York at that time?
It was more sad, at least for me, for my group of people. I think it was more sad than terrifying. Actually, I think the assumption that we made was that if anybody was diagnosed with HIV, they were going to die. And I think that there was a period, and you know, that we spent most of our time. There was one hospital in New York, St. Vincent's, that had a wing for AIDS patients. And I mean, we would go there to visit whomever, and we would run into other members going to visit other whomevers. But it was also the AIDS epidemic that really pushed the need for a certain kind of special interest meeting in Manhattan, maybe all of New York City, and that we really fought for. There were a few people who were opposed to any kind of special interest meetings, but that whole AIDS epidemic and how it decimated our population made it possible for all those gay meetings that opened up, and that most of them still exist actually to this day. And there's also illness and recovery meetings. So that epidemic, I don't even know what NA would have looked like today had those people had an opportunity to survive that diagnosis. But I would have to say that our membership would probably be double by now than what it is now, rather.
It's a very powerful question. Just the thought of that I was living in Los Angeles at that time, and I know you guys were going through it a lot more intensely, but it was really a sad time. It doubly hit the fellowship because you mentioned the gay community being really hit hard at that time, but also the intravenous drug user was the another demographic being hit by AIDS. So this combination was just horrible at the time. And we should say how it is very gratifying now to hear people with the HIV virus saying things like undetectable and viral loads that are manageable and treatment that is managing it. And, you know, it's very gratifying to see that change occur. But we're talking now about a period before that happened when it was an awful scourge.
I think the other thing also is that we are a subsection of society, and so we have all the same issues that society at large has, including prejudice, whether it's racial or sexual orientation or whatever else it might be. And I can say that here in Manhattan, sometimes when things like this happen, you think that everybody's going to scatter to the four winds. But the reality is we hung in and took care of each other at a time when most of us didn't have two dimes to rub together, you know, that we took care of, because there weren't a lot of services for people with HIV, whether they were recovering addicts or active addicts or there weren't a lot of services available. So when you got that diagnosis, if you didn't have family or a bank account, you were screwed. And so for some reason, whatever, and I'll have to say it's probably the application of the spiritual principles that we learn about here, that we took care of each other. You don't see that very often.
Okay, and one other event that happened in New York City was 9/11, of course, and I just wonder if there is a NA history, NA community story to be told there.
I think that the way that it affected the New York City, like the five boroughs, was probably completely different from the way. I think that it was a much more visceral experience for us here, simply because we were literally affected by it in terms of how we could travel, in terms of the buildings that we no longer had access to, in terms of not even being able for a time to go from one borough to another, you know, and in terms of just the literal, you know, the looking for the, you know, just the actual things that were going on downtown. Mm-hmm. Whereas for a lot of other people, it may have been a more emotional experience. But I will say that for here, it was the same exact thing, is that we hung together. I mean, it wasn't so much when we were able to find each other or communicate with each other, we figured out a way to stay together.
I have a very unique perspective. I was five blocks away working when the first plane hit, and I saw it. I have pictures of it. I have pictures of the second plane hitting. And I was living in what was at that time called the hot zone. Below Houston Street was the hot zone. Anything below Houston Street was the hot zone. It was very difficult to move. That Tuesday, I was scheduled to speak at a meeting on Bleecker Street, which was just above the hot zone. And the person who chaired the meeting, Big Walter, called me and said, he can't get downtown, the trains are shut. Would I go there anyway and speak and get somebody to chair the meeting? The meeting went off the night the towers went down. The meeting came off. It was sparsely attended, but there was still maybe 15 to 20 people there. It's notorious for being a very big meeting, the Bleecker Street Tuesday meeting. The next day I was down working on top of the pile, on top of the rubble. Fires were still burning. And there were two other NA members that showed up to work the top of the pile. And we were all there. We recognized each other. We said hello. And then we went about doing work to clean the rubble. And these two guys that I saw there are still around. I still see them. It had a profound effect on everybody. It tightened up the fellowship in general, because we were now all survivors, not just survivors of the disease of addiction, but we were now survivors of the towers going down, and was an additional bonding factor that took place in the meetings in Manhattan and Queens. The people in the meetings really bonded together.
Catherine interjected here, the meetings were packed. It was where you went to express your grief and loss with people you could trust. That's a powerful story. And this book is full of powerful stories. Here's the last paragraph of the preface. Unlike other 12-step histories, there are no stars here, no founders' photos to hang on the meeting room wall. Instead, you will meet the most unlikely combination of people ever assembled to bring about a miracle. They represent the full spectrum of human diversity that is uniquely New York. Ex-cons and punk rockers, drugstore cowboys and junkie girls, bookmakers and bookkeepers, gutter hypes and Wall Street brokers, juvenile delinquents and pill-popping grandmas, made men and clergymen, debutantes and desperados, hustlers, scammers, cat burglars, upright citizens, street people, scary people, misfits of every stripe, some of them nuts.
This ragtag group of characters is what the God of our understanding assembled to bring Narcotics Anonymous as we know it today to New York. The incredible things they accomplished between 1981 and 1985 is the impossible dream we celebrate in this book. Our aim has been to give this history continuity, where it came from, how it got started, why it disappeared, how it reappeared, and how it grew from two meetings to the fourth largest region of Narcotics Anonymous in the world. At last, after 8 years, we have a book, and our task is done.
Well, I want to thank you all. I personally have been a student of the what we'll call the New York Fellowship for 20 years. And it was my pleasure to interview Charles Winnick when he was alive and really try to put together some documentary evidence of this before there was a concerted effort and the internet and all of that. So I was really delighted to see in this book that you covered it. And I think that you put the facts out there and the interpretation of these facts, people will have to arrive at their own conclusions about it. It will lead to spirited discussions about the origins of our fellowship. But I think it's a wonderful story. And I just wanted to read something from page 106. And it's really the point in the story where there are two meetings in New York, one in Queens and one in Bronx. And this is 1981. And it's a great story that how these two meetings came to be. And I'm quoting here. Within less than a month, addicts seeking recovery in NA had two meetings to go to, by subway or carpool, and they supported each other like lost children in the wilderness. And I think that's just a beautiful statement. Wherever NA starts, the struggles are the same, but this is just a wonderful story of starting out with just a small group of addicts reaching out, supporting each other, and continuing to grow and help this fellowship flourish. I want to thank you for this effort. It's a wonderful book.